This is CliffCentral.com.
Not many people have a life story quite like the man sitting in front of me now. At age 21, he gave up a life of privilege for one of danger and sacrifice, including 27 years of living in exile while working for the ANC. He was also one of the founding members of Umkhonto weSizwe in Natal in 1961. He's been a government minister, was a leading member of the ANC during the apartheid era, and in his post-activism life, he's written another book, which is called Catching Tadpoles, The Shaping of a Young Rebel. When I was talking to him just a moment ago, he said he's done it backwards. Should have written the memoir first about the early life, but he's left that for an age where he can look back on it with a little more objectivity and a sense of humor, which maybe when you were a minister and all the rest of it, you didn't really have the time or the purchase to be able to do. Ronnie Kasrils, it's a pleasure to see you, sir.
Thanks, Gareth. And glad to be with you.
And the book is really it's charming. I mean, it's a story of a young man who really had this dislike for authoritarianism and authority.
Seemed to be in my bones.
Right from the start. Someone who lived this really interesting and sometimes shambolic life. But you had in your youth the makings of the man who would end up being this activist and this fighter. And a guy who obviously was not afraid to make his opinions felt and known. It's a pleasure to read about the young life of Ronnie Kasrils. What motivated you to do this?
After writing three books about South African struggle from a personal point of view, so almost memoirs, certainly the first and main book, which is called Armed and Dangerous, really takes off where this book ends off. So that starts in 1960, Sharpeville, and has about 6-7 pages of background into my youth and who my parents were. By the time I completed the third book recently, about Jacob Zuma and my relationship with him.
Yeah, which was brilliant, by the way. Loved that book. That caused a sensation.
Yeah, it should. The publisher, Jacana Publishers, said to me, Ronnie, it's about time you really go back to the very beginning, because the born frees want to know why a young white gave everything up, as well as others of all colours and backgrounds. So why don't you start at the beginning? And I liked the idea because I felt I could get away from the hard, politically correct politics and let my hair down, even though I don't have much left. So it was very enjoyable to write, going right back into my childhood and then just through the first 20 years of my life. So the idea came from the publisher. And I then got going in quick style.
The publishers obviously were onto something, because there's some real stories in here. I'm trying to think of what kind of a kid Ronnie Kasrils might have been. I mean, you come from an interesting family. It was ironic to me that your grandfather, Nathan, was in intelligence. You ended up being intelligence minister. Did you also find that a bit ironic?
Yes, and I didn't know that he had, in a sense, had that kind of life.
Yeah.
He was from Lithuania.
Right.
Came out to South Africa in around about 1880 to prospect for diamonds. So a little bit ahead of the big wave of Lithuanian and Latvian immigrants.
There were pogroms during the Tsarist times in Russia, right?
Very, very heavy, and especially around that time, 1880 onwards, but there had always been. So the Jews were picked on now and again, and they were quite horrific, with usually the nobility, village headmen, or the Tsar himself, for their own needs to divert the populace. Yeah. From the problems of the day, or the wars, or whatever.
Seems to be something that history keeps repeating. And
that's
blame the
right.
Jews.
And the kind of xenophobic outbreaks would be stoked into attacks, the Cossacks galloping into the Jewish villages and cutting people down, knocking heads, and so on. So that was one incredible burden that they were petrified of, and the other was their absolute poverty, the impoverishment there. Of course, there's always an elite who rule over the others, but in general, it was an impoverished and dire existence, yeah. in terrible cold weather and so on. Of course, they were used to that in a sense. They had migrated there through Central Europe and out of Spain and originally out of the Middle East, I suppose. But there had been a lot of conversions as well. Anyway, to get into his migration, he comes here for economic advantage and looking for a fortune, and also to get away from that kind of background.
Did you have to do a lot of research into this, or was a lot of this already known to you?
I knew part of this from my father, and when I came out with my original autobiography, the memoir Armed and Dangerous, I wrote about how he, prospecting in the Kimberley and Northwest Transvaal area of that time, you know, there was also gold bearing, diamond bearing in that, in those parts. How he had got involved, and quite soon started working for the British, Kimberley Rifles, and there it was shown, and I've seen the documents published in the book, that he'd become something of an intelligence agent, it seemed, for the British. Was travelling around a lot between Cape Town and Kimberley, had papers to take him back to Russia and back, where he went several times. And I think in return for these kind of documents, he was prepared or signed up to be an agent for the British, looking around to see what was going on, Boer movements, that kind of stuff. But after that book was first published in 1993, a much older cousin of mine who knew him, he died very soon after I was born, my grandfather, Nathan Casrolls, said to me, "You don't seem to realize that our mutual grandfather was actually a double agent. He was working for Koos de la Rey, the famous General de la Rey of North of Western Transvaal."
So the British didn't know.
No, he was absolutely living on the edge as a double agent. He would have been shot out of hand if they had known. So this cousin of mine from Israel, where he had gone, wrote to me and said he had seen the certificate from De La Rey, which said that Nathan Casrolls was a hoya scapegoater in spion, a sharpshooter and spy, and he managed to keep that guys going. And obviously giving them the information they required. So he must have been a man of pretty strong nerve. I didn't know this. I didn't clone myself off him. I wasn't aping him. My interest in intelligence matters comes about through being in Umkhonto weSizwe from 1961 on. By 1983, I became Chief of Military Intelligence in the MK for the ANC.
But it's interesting. I mean, I do think if there's any such thing as genetic memory, I mean, the fact that either you or your grandfather, unbeknown to you at the time, might have been shot for some of your various doings. You know, this is you guys didn't mind living on the edge.
Yeah, so, you know, you said genetic memory, and of course, I can't say I believe in that, but a lot of people argue the toss and say, no, it's in your genes and so on. Certainly what my father said to me, my parents weren't particularly political or religious, but when I started showing left-wing inclinations, they said that I took after my grandfather in that respect, because a motive for working for the Boers was the fact that he really loathed Cecil John Rhodes and British imperialism.
Wow.
So there was that kind of left-wing politics in the man, which growing up in the Russian Empire, and if you were Jewish, because of the persecution under the Tsars, socialism, Marxism, communism, as in Lenin's Bolshevism, had taken hold, and a lot of Jews were drawn to it. So he must have been affected to some degree in that sense, but he never joined the South African Communist Party, which did exist here from 1921 onwards.
You said that you were persuaded to write the book because people want to know what it was that made a young white guy join these left-wing parties, to get involved in a fight that really didn't seem like it was a white people's fight. And I'm curious, because reading through the book, there are a lot of different stories. But are there seminal moments in your mind? And some of them you do go into here, which is why I'm guessing a little bit at
sure.
this. But were there seminal moments where you looked at things and you thought, this just can't be the way that I continue to live my life? I'm not prepared to put up and turn a blind eye to some of these things that are going on. It's important for me to get involved. I mean, it's a tough thing for a young man to decide.
Yes, but it does start when you're pretty young, I would say. And I use the term the seminal moments. I use the term turning points of life, the first of which occurs when I'm 7 going 8. And I have a vivid memory of seeing an African man in the middle of Johannesburg being beaten into the gutter by 4 young white hooligans using knuckle dusters, and the blood streaming from his head. He's being kicked and he's down in the gutter. This is a white man's town for those born frees. In those days, when you went downtown Joburg or Yeovil, where I grew up, and the story starts there, or Hillbrow, where I become something of a bohemian, it's all white city to a remarkable degree. And you have Africans moving through the city centres. You see messengers, and of course they're the domestic servants. But that's all that you really see. So this is occurring, and I'm with my mother, who was taking me for a treat to what we called the bioscopes in those days, the cinema. And she pulls me out of the way, and we rush across the road. There's bedlam. People are running away in all directions. And we hear a white woman's voice shrieking, "Stop, stop, you're killing him." They speak to her in the most derogatory, foul language, telling her to mind her own business, "You white bitch," kind of thing. And a white guy standing nearby, one of these know-alls, who's certainly not sympathetic to what's happening, but he's a know-all, so he's explaining to people around, while the man's being kicked to hell, he's saying, "Oh, well, those guys deserved it, that native boy deserved it, because he wouldn't get out of their way." And who was this African gentleman? He was in his 20s, very nicely attired in a sports jacket and slacks, and I remember seeing and noticing his black and white brogues, his smart shoes, very classy, and they obviously took a dislike to that, and maybe he didn't get out of the way quickly enough, because white man was king, black should walk in the gutter. So they pounced on him in that way. I was so traumatized that week I had difficulty sleeping, and my mind was all over the place. So the key thing of a turning point is, this is 1946, just after the war. I'm born in 38, so I lived through the war in a Jewish neighborhood of Jewish migrant grandparents. And of course, we know what's happening in Nazi Germany and throughout where my grandparents lived. The Jews were being massacred in Lithuania, Latvia, even before they were thrown into the concentration camps to be gassed and to be starved to death. So I was saying to my mother a week later, "Is this how Jews were being treated, or blacks treated the way Jews were treated in Germany?" And I remember her wonderfully dark brown eyes looking deeply into me, and she's searching for the words. Not an educated woman. She didn't do a matric. She went to work at the age of 16. And she says to me, Ronald, it's not like that in the fact that, as you know, our people, the Jews, were going through absolute hell under the Nazis. But it starts this way. It starts when a black person can be beaten in front of even the police, in front of white adults, and nobody lifts a finger. It starts with this horrible language you hear from our neighbors, even some of our relatives in the Yeovil streets. Why we say to you, we must never use these words. And those words were the K words and the N words and so on. We've got to be kind and decent to people. She says, when it starts with that kind of language and behavior, it can grow into something monstrous. And that's why, as we learn in the Jewish religion, and that we weren't terribly religious, but she says our lesson is that we must treat others as we wish them to treat us. At that point in time, I thought this was the Jewish way. It's later, when I'm in my teens, I'd understand this is Christianity, this is Islam, this is the Hindu religion, and
so on. The golden rule, right?
So it's universal. Mm. But it's the empathy, I would say, I get from a mother who keeps my mind open to suffering and to have that kind of empathy. Because if I can just quickly get this in, I've had neighbors. We lived in quite crowded conditions in the flatland of Joburg, and I could hear parents of my best friend saying, when this kind of question was raised, they would say, don't worry about the blacks. They used to rough life. They used to living in bad conditions. They used to brutality. You mustn't worry about them. You worry about yourself. Now, I would say, and I'll say this in retrospect, I wasn't thinking this as a 7-8-year-old. I would say that this closed the mind to the natural empathy children have. They hate to see cruelty to animals, and they hate to see that cruelty to other kids and to human beings. Now, when parents keep your senses open to that kind of empathy with life, then it keeps your mind open. But if they say the contrary, you start becoming little and mean, and your horizons close, and you become hardened. I would say that was a key turning point. There were other elements of this kind. I hated getting on the swings in parks and seeing black kids, sometimes with their parents, peering into the park, and they couldn't enjoy what we were enjoying. I would immediately, when I noticed this, I would feel depressed, and I would get off the swing and off the slide. So it comes in sometimes big ways and sometimes incrementally. But if I can just complete, thanks to radio, we've got the time,
sure,
and you said so, Gareth. When I'm in my teens, I'm 16, 17, going into the matric years, and I'm against authority. I don't like it. There's too much bullying and corporal punishment, the cuts you get, the prefect system. And I'm more interested there in sports. That's how I can prove that I'm up to the rest of them. But I suddenly hear the teacher in those two matric years saying, we're now going to study the French Revolution. And it's the word revolution that appealed to me. So I suddenly started listening, all ears, as they say. And this teacher, Teddy Gordon, who had been away in the war in the Royal Navy, was obviously Jewish, but that didn't come across, and he wasn't a terribly religious guy. Bumped into him in the synagogue once or twice after I left school. He starts explaining the conditions of the peasants, the landless, the masses of France and the absolute monarchs. and the way they and the nobility lived in with their power in Europe of the 18th century, and the way he depicted it, he had to be careful in a police apartheid state not to be so outright with it. But if you had empathy, you could see the images of the aristocracy and the serfs, the landless, the peasants, in terms of the very wealthy of South Africa, and the downtrodden. And that started changing my whole outlook. I really started devouring books, devouring history, English literature, and I suddenly started brightening up as a student. That opened my mind to something far more than the basic thoughts that I'd had, which I've recounted when I was younger. I wanted now to understand the world that we lived in.
You know, first of all, that story about your mum taking you at 7 or 8 years old and explaining to you the similarities, the areas of mutual kind of pain between what the Jews were going through, your people, as she called them, and then what blacks in South Africa were going through. And for her to take the time and trouble to explain that to a young child, where so many parents would prefer to breeze past it and put it away and let their children deal with that later on, when they maybe understand it better, that sows the seeds of something very special. It sows, and I don't mean special in terms of lovely and adorable.
No,
special in terms of this is a moment for you to start. Yes. Your brain starts to calculate the environment a little differently to other kids.
Sure thing. You know, I mentioned this in a few sentences, maybe a paragraph or two, in my first autobiography, Omnidangerous.
Yeah.
And there was one sole critic who questioned that a seven-year-old could think that way. And I knew that what I was recounting was as it had happened. It was
a good memory, by the way.
Well, we can come to why. But and I think people have good memories potentially if they develop them and talk about these things a lot, which was the case, discussed with my mother particularly, my father to some degree. But it was this kind of recounting that sharpened my memory. And, somebody, a critic in a review says, no, it's impossible, seven-year-old, how could he think that way? I've read a great deal for this book about memory. And the psychiatrists, the psychologists, they all agree. Firstly, that your initial memories can start when you're about 2 years old, and they give examples. I can't claim that. Something very dramatic has to happen when you're two or so. But it's essentially when you're going from three to four, and it's the language that enables you, as you learn to speak, that's what reinforces memory. And by the age of five, that is becoming quite fluent or fluid. And if you've got a sympathy for particular things, then some of the fragments of memory you can start joining up. And it's not as though you're looking at these things in a fully cognitive or intellectual way, but the cognitive aspect does come in. And I quote one of these writers, Bull Brady, I think the name, he says that your first real memory is your cognitive birthday. They go on, these psychologists, to explain that it's really from five and six, and these young ages, that you can develop a very acute memory. What I add to it is if you are sensitive enough and become observant as a result, you start remembering better. So that what happened to me with this attack on the African man downtown Joburg would have sensitized me, given what my mother had said as well, to study and to look at behavior in the neighborhood, how we were relating to the the black domestic workers, for instance, or the messengers, all the beggars you bumped into downtown Joburg. And I've got a lot of anecdotes where I remember this very vividly. There's also the fact of learning from my father where this ability, now it's sort of 10-year-old Ronnie, going with a father who's a worker in a sense, white collar, so lower middle class because he's a commercial traveller, representative for a factory, right. And he's selling quite low class sweets, mainly to the less well off areas, including mixed race, Indian areas, poor white, and of course near the townships. And like any kid, you want to go with your dad in a holiday, school holidays, to carry his case, his briefcase, or in his case, his sample case, to see what goes on. And we would go into the Greek corner cafe or the Portuguese cafe tea room, and we would go into the Chinese and the Indian stores near the townships. And we would go in, my father, quite conservative in his dress style, the three-piece suit and hat, which he would doff to Mr. Ismail or Mr. Muhammad, who in turn would say, "Good day, Mr. Casual. Let's sit down and have some tea before we discuss my order. Would the little boy like a cool drink or an ice cream?" And I would sit down and I would look at these people.
But the contrast between that and that incident that you saw at seven must have also impressed upon you that if people treat each other with respect, it's just such a... it's such a beguiling and decent way for people to get along.
Gareth, you've just connected something which I hadn't thought of, that there is that connection. Sorry to butt in, but I'm excited at your observation. You see, I'm seven, and then I'm talking about when I'm 10 with my dad.
Yes.
And in the book, I actually can't explain. I say how riding back with him in his 1948 Plymouth, I'm feeling very happy. I'm feeling warm and relaxed, proud of my father, because I say there was this respect shown mutually. I hadn't connected it with the earlier incident in the way you have, and that is clear. I would immediately agree with your observation that it's that contrast in this in this environment, the context of the time, which is pretty savage, and you know, there are demonstrations, protests, sometimes called riots, there are strikes, people being shot down. You hear of this, you see it
as a child
in the newspapers.
But as a child, this must have been a massive thing for you, because here you have quiet respect, people doffing their hats, calling each other Mr. This, Mr. That, let's have some tea. And then you're hearing filthy language and racial epithets and people being abusive and brutal.
Exactly.
And there's obviously one that attracts a child and one that
repels.
Distinctly repels you.
Sure. So I write about how that feeling and the observations of my father at work gave me tremendous respect for him. By contrast, other commercial travellers living next door to us were kind of harder and in some senses very nice. I liked them. They were uncles, but they had a nasty side when they started talking about the blacks in the streets.
Yeah.
And when over the card tables, because that generation, I go into it, these guys loved going to turf and tan horse racing on the Jewish Sabbath, by the way. They weren't very devout, and they played poker all the time. And I could hear the conversations. I would sidle up to the card tables. My mother would be serving beautiful sandwiches for these guys. They would be having their whiskies, and I could help myself the sandwiches, and I'd listen in. And the contrast in terms of the way my father might remark about, for instance, the 1946 mine workers' strike, which was taking place, and had to keep him off the roads at some point because he travelled the countryside roads. and these other guys who were saying things like, the only way to deal with these blacks is, you know, let the police shoot the lot of them, that kind of stuff. And my father, without being very political, as I said, would come up with a better way of looking at it. So there was that kind of contrast, which obviously rubbed off on me. This little boy who was now studying these people all around me, from teachers to relatives to card sharps to the gamblers at the table.
Well, you did have an uncanny ability to remember all these details, and I think that must have helped you in your later life, your political life too. But just to dwell on the French Revolution and this teacher, Mr. Gordon, that you spoke of for a second, it's interesting that, you know, there's, I think it was Chesterton who said, if you're young and you're not a lefty, you don't have a heart. And if you're old and you're not conservative, you don't have a brain.
Exactly. It was said to me as well in the autobiography, Armed and Dangerous. So by 1961 or 60, 61 to 2, I'm working in Durban for a British firm, Lever Brothers, as a TV cinema script writer. Although we didn't have TV, but we were gearing for that. And when my politics came out full to the fore, they were very worried. I was this blue-eyed kid that they'd poached from a Johannesburg film studio, which is what I did after leaving school. And they were very concerned and tried to wean me away from the politics. And my boss, a guy called Rupert Ayres from Britain, very avuncular guy, very concerned, said to me, you know, Ronnie, in England, we've got this saying, if you're not a communist at the age of 21, you haven't a heart, but if you're still a communist at the age of 31, you haven't a mind. Just what you've said.
Well, what I love about the book too is it shows us a little bit of the Ronnie Casserolles that politics didn't allow us to see, and that you probably weren't allowed to show, certainly not when you were in the kinds of movements that you're in. There was a lot of secrecy, and you go into this in your book about Jacob Zuma, which I thought was interesting too, about the fact that you had to shut your mouth around certain people. And there were certain things that it was convenient to not dwell on and to not remember. And being a person almost is pushed aside, because you become an operative, you become an agent. You have to be loyal to the cause, because you're fighting something tremendous and something very powerful. This is a Ronnie Casserolles I don't think a lot of people, except maybe your very close circles, maybe family, maybe very good friends that you could trust, got to see.
Yeah, look, there is partly what you say. I'm not arguing against you, that given the necessary discipline of an organization, and not just an ordinary political organization in ordinary times, but one in which you were illegal and underground and fighting a war, and there were dire consequences. You make mistakes, you talk out too much.
People die.
You drop secrets, and the consequences are there. People get captured, they get tortured to death, they get killed, they get ambushed, etc. So you have to develop, to survive, this disciplined collective commitment to a secrecy which you do not talk to outsiders about. And even within, there's the question of the need to know. So you can be very close to some of your fellow comrades, but you're doing different things because there's a division of labor. Some are collecting information, some are spies in the sense of the word that we understand, others are in combat, others are people who organize international solidarity, etc. You're not going to talk about innermost trade secrets to each other. You keep that in your own bubble. There's the need to know. So that builds up even a greater degree of secrecy. But the area where I said not totally in agreement with the way you formulated, not that you were meaning to, because I'm sure you understood that the people you read about, people from Walter Sisulu to and Nelson Mandela to Chris Hani to Kathrada to Joe Slovo and Ruth First and people like that, these are absolutely wonderful human beings who have incredible empathy. So if we talk about my empathy for the underdog, these are people, whether they from a white background where you give up privilege, or you're from an African, Indian, mixed race background, where of course you're not giving up any privilege, but you're there with your people, you're
taking
and
on a huge
your
burden.
Desire and your whole motive is to struggle to lift your people out of the mud, to bring freedom to them. So you talking about people who are very humanistic.
Oh, no.
That's the start.
By no means did I mean any lack of that quality or character was in any of you. But I, the reason I bring it up is because I wonder if this book hasn't allowed you to be a little cathartic about what was a hard thing for any human to do, because you build up this carapace around you that, you know, you have to be impervious to letting too much of yourself out or taking too much on board, because it'll hobble you.
Yes,
when you're underground, you know.
Yes, sure. So it is that, because you become, especially in talking to the public and going public, there is, in relation to people who are actually rather unconventional to start, and would accept the unconventionality within society, when they come to write their memoirs, as many have already, there's been too much of a political correctness. So there's no letting down the hair, because I would say so many of my comrades are still in that particular mindset of presenting the best possible features.
Almost propagandizing themselves. Sympathetically.
It is that kind of element. I understand the point and how you're digging into the onion or peeling the onion. I'll give you a good example of something, again, that surprised me. And I like being surprised, like you did when you drew the connection between my two anecdotes of going with my father into the stores and my mother and seeing the man being beaten. So I'm with LB Sachs at one of my book launches this past month. They've actually been 13, which is why I'm a bit hoarse, in 30 days.
Working hard.
And LB Sachs, who comes from, he's born into that left-wing political context. His father's a communist and his mother. His father's leading trade unionist in the country, a man called Solly Sachs. And he grows up in that environment. The whites who were involved in the struggle and the ones I met in 1960 were mainly from an older generation, the Slovo generation, 15 years older than me, and some a bit older than that, and some younger ones like LB Sachs, but he's 8 years or so older than me. And they are a very small grouping, maybe 200 in Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, and Port Elizabeth, you know, maybe 500, very, very small. I met 20, 30 as a grouping in Joburg, and there's a wider grouping of maybe another 50. Anyway, he's up from Cape Town, and that's how I meet him at a particular meeting of the organization we belong to there, Congress of Democrats, which was for the small minority of whites supporting the ANC. At the book launch, he says how I was in 1960, 61, and he says that Ronnie was different from all of us. We were far too serious. He was more lighthearted. When we sang songs, they were the standard songs of struggle, and he would get into rock and roll mode. And he went on like that, and he said, you know, we were all anti-establishment on the police, but he would actually get involved in fist fights with these guys, and we would just use our smart language and so on. So it is something of the background that I came from. And I think the fact that most of my erstwhile and current comrades as well were born into a movement, whereas I wasn't. And that's why I would say I'm a little less conventional than them within the actual organization, and have been able to find a bit of a different voice to them when it came to criticizing the ANC. Those who were reared on their mother's milk in relation to Communist Party and ANC can find it incredibly difficult to raise a word of criticism. I don't have that kind of break on me. I managed to loosen it after 50 years of adult involvement.
Well, that is a subject of your other books largely, but what I'm motivated to ask you about here is whether or not you ever found that Ronnie Casserles, who was enjoying life before he gave up privilege and joined the struggle full-time and made it a life, and not always a very comfortable life and not always a very easy life, whether that struggle guy ever looked back on those bohemian parties in Hillbrow, smoking a joint now and then, having a good time, whether you ever looked back on that and thought, wow, I maybe just gave up what could have been a very easy life.
I don't regret at all having given that up. One regret I have is at this stage of my life, I would love to be making films or having had a life in a career in making films, because I love films. My one son's rather involved in that as well, as though something I've passed on to him. But I actually would have loved to have developed a career in films. I'm doing something with filming now, documentaries, that kind of stuff. Albie Sachs is waxing lyrical in relation to what he's doing in that respect as well. I would say that I enjoyed life far more by actually breaking with that background, because it was actually very shallow, despite being unconventional, despite breaking away from the white norms and values, into one in which I found the African people in a equal sense, and they were incredibly generous in the way I was accepted and others were by the ANC, Communist Party, and so on. One gained tremendously in that respect. And then in relation to the internationalism that comes with being part of socialist, Marxist, communist involvement, I'll just tell you something about Fezeka Kuzwayo, who was called Kwezi. And she was in exile, and we know there was the rape allegation against Jacob Zuma.
Yes. Reedy Klabi's been doing some
how
amazing
she
work
died just a couple of years ago.
Yes.
She was asked about exile, where she had had some very horrendous experiences, including being raped by other youngsters in the ANC community, etc. And people imagined that she had had a horrendous life and would never have wanted to go into exile. But she made it clear, certainly to me, as well as other youngsters who were her peers in exile, that they gained so much from being part of an ANC community in exile with all the hardships. They learned so much, and there was a great deal of joy and camaraderie in that kind of community, which is what I've experienced in my life as well.
It's still, looking at the contrasts, it's really interesting to imagine the kind of Ronnie Casserles that could have been. I mean, we all benefit from the fact that, you know, you eventually became our Minister of Defense, you became our Minister of Intelligence. You know, the fact that the ANC has made the South Africa that we have today, with all of its faults, we acknowledge those, I think, too. And it's to your credit that you are not universally forgiving of the ANC and some of the policies of the last 10 years, certainly. I mentioned to you when we met just now how the men and women of integrity that left when Thabo Mbeki left, and you were one of them, seemed to have created a watershed moment for the party at that point too. And the people who didn't after that have found it very difficult to show that they have the backbone that we need to take things forward. Is it a similar situation for you now, where you almost find yourself more comfortable on the outside pissing in, as it may be? Because you did this in a very big sense to your own community when you grew up. Not just because you were anti-authority, but also because this revolutionary, this rebellious guy is still, he's still in there fighting every day. And I mean, you don't mind who you make as an enemy along the way. If it contrasts for you too much with your own ideals and your own values, you're not afraid.
I think, you know, that's exactly it. It's in terms of one's values and ideals and principles. So that when I joined the ANC in 1960 and then the Communist Party, I wasn't joining a name. I was joining what the ANC and the Communist Party stood for. In other words, their values and their principles, and the people who influenced me at that stage, like Roly Orenstein in the Communist Party and Joe Slovo, Ruth First, Walter Sisulu, Govan and Mbeki and so on, were people I absolutely looked up to and adored. Some had incredible humor, like Joe Slovo. Others were very taciturn, rather like my father, Govan and Mbeki. But I absolutely worshipped them for their steadfastness, their values, their non-racism, the fact that it wasn't about acquiring material wealth at all, but about serving the people and the better cause that the ANC and the Communist Party stood for. So when they deviated, and speaking especially, let me say, about the ANC from the time of Zuma, I'm not betraying what the ANC stood for: the Freedom Charter, the redistribution, the dignity for people, the service for people. But I still abide by that. So I'm the one who's actually upholding the values of those organizations. I think it's clear, and it's not just Jacob Zuma, but it's so many of them who are only in it, who fight for their positions, join particular sides in factions, the disputes, the factions, Communist Party or ANC, and are taking up positions for selfish, not selfless, purposes, to get on, to get position, wealth and power, and to get those positions basically so that they can cream off what should be going to the poor. They are reaping the dividends of the wealth of this country, as we've seen, as larcenists, as people who are absolute common thieves, and they are despicable. So I want to be able to speak my mind. I don't want to pretend that these are fine people. And I certainly don't miss their company, and I've found much better company and real comradeship from the outside. And I'm not talking here about business people and the wealthy. I'm talking about people who the innermost of the Communist Party and the ANC despise, those who are still trying, whether they trade unionists, intellectuals, academics, workers, who are saying, we decry what you are doing and we want to fix this country in the way that Sisulu and Tambo and Slovo had in mind. That's what I'm serving. So I'm not the traitor. They are the traitors.
Well, it's probably an appropriate moment for us to just reflect on the life of Ben Turok, who we just heard died this morning.
Well, it's so sad. It's a blow. I've just heard of just as we were coming on.
My sympathies to you and everyone else who knew him, obviously. This was a man who also was of deep principle and made some serious enemies when he spoke his mind.
Absolutely. And he spent time in prison. He was in Nomkhonto Wesizwe from the beginning. Previous to that, he was in the Communist Party, in the underground, in the organization I refer to, Albie and myself, the Congress of Democrats as well. And he was an outstanding intellectual. Coming back to South Africa, he's been in Parliament as a backbench MP for many years, and he was speaking truth to power. Remaining inside the tent, he had to put something of a brake on the extent of his critique. But once he left Parliament, and this is the last 5 years or so, we've seen how profound his voice has been, and especially about putting the economy right and in opposing the corruption. So my heart goes out to his wife and sons. They're a wonderful family, and one thing we can say is that he had a very rich and meaningful life,
and his contribution will not go unnoticed. I think history will be kind to him.
Very profound contribution indeed. This country has really lost an outstanding voice, intellect, and human being, a champion of freedom and the struggle against poverty.
There's so much I would still love to talk to you about, but I do want to focus on this book for the purposes at least of this interview, and we get you in again if you don't mind, because there's...
Sure thing, I'd be open to that.
There are elements of the philosophy and the ideology you've espoused that I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk a little bit about Israel, because there's constant controversy on that side. And all of that we can save for another time. Let's just say that this book, Catching Tadpoles, if you want to understand a little bit more about the mind of a young man who becomes the person that we know most of your story about, the revolutionary, the freedom fighter, the Mkhonto Wesizwe man, the minister later on, and someone who was so integral to what happened in South Africa post 1994. This is just a terrific read, and it's beautifully put together. Your memory really is extraordinary, and thank you for spending some time with us this morning.
Well, thanks, Gareth. It's been my privilege. I appreciate this. If I could just say that the title, Catching Tadpoles, in the reading, the good reader will see quite easily that this just isn't a title about a young boy and his love for tadpoles, that softness of youth, but it actually has a metaphorical meaning. And I leave it to readers to get the book and discover what that's all about.
It's incredible. And you did mention Bill Briggs earlier, but there's also a James Wright line or two that you throw in about tadpoles at the very beginning.
Yes, it's a lovely, from a lovely verse of his.
So we've left a cliffhanger for people to discover in the work
sure,
itself.
Sure, they can get it at all good bookstores, from Exclusive throughout the country to places like Love Books in Melville and Book Lounge in Cape Town, Ike's Books in Durban, everywhere.
Very good. Ronnie Kasrils, thank you so much. Catching Tadpoles, The Shaping of a Young Rebel, his latest book, and plenty more stories where that came from. But if you want to get into some of these stories, this is a great place to start. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Good day.
This is CliffCentral.com.